This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today, we are doing our wrap-up of Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. All 30 chapters have been read, discussed, analyzed, tarot and oracle cards pulled for.
Yeah.
So, again, overall, how do you feel departing from this book?
That is a question I was not prepared for. You know, it's funny because it's like we read these books over such a long duration. It's kind of, it's an interesting feeling because I know we're about to head to the last book. So it's the beginning of the end. That's what this feels like.
Yeah, beginning of the end. Again, as you said, it was interesting for me to revisit this book again and reading it so slowly because this was my favorite as a kid and still is in my top three, I'm sure. And it's the type where I would just put the audiobook like CD in and it would just literally be background like ambience for when I was like doing chores or when I was like falling asleep. So a lot of those like Tom Riddle memories, you know, are so deeply ingrained. But I think because we read it so slowly, I was more able to fully appreciate the huge tonal duality.
Yeah.
That is present in this book in a way that obviously it's pretty obvious, but it's literally two totally different stories, you know, existing parallel to each other because we've got Harry being this like observer, like learning all of this history. And then we have his actual life and the goings on of his life, which consist of, you know, romantic drama and obsessing over Draco Malfoy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a, I mean, that's something that I think I talked about a little bit too, or I know we talked about a lot when we talked about this book is like one chapter would be very heavy, like teen angst, and the other would be kind of like a continuation of the story. It almost felt like Harry included some of that just to, because he sensed where his readers might be at that point in their life, that they might be kind of desire some of that, I guess. Mm-hmm.
And I guess another thing I thought of is so much of Harry the Writer puts like a lot of foundation in the earlier books. And so I was thinking about it, and it's just, again, from a 7-book series, the fact that something as so critical and important as the Horcruxes, that the fact that we only just find out about them, like, by the end of book 6, even though retroactively, like, we've been exposed to Horcruxes such as, you know, the diary, you know, and things like that. So seeds were planted, but the fact that we, like, just this whole magical concept, because, I don't know, I guess sometimes I think when I first read it, like, I was more thinking that there would be various plot twists, like with characters, but I think after the huge reveal of the prophecy being, being disclosed by Dumbledore, that I'm like, okay, well, that's the big, like, magical concept, and now all the other twists are gonna be, like, plot and character and stuff, and it's like, but no, we have another big magical magical reveal and info dump. And I'm like, oh, this is getting pretty late.
Yeah. Well, that does happen. I think at some point I was like, wow, this book is getting thinner and some of the things have not been wrapped up yet. Interesting. I was just thinking, like, I don't know. We're going to rank the books at the end of this. And I mean, the fact that Dumbledore dies, if you're listening to this podcast at this point, like, you should probably know that already. But hard to rank that any sort of high, but I did, just for that reason alone.
Indeed. And then, again, just another note I had was, again, we get the brand new information of the Horcruxes, but I like that it gives added context of things we already knew about, but in an entertaining way. It's not like repetition or, you know, throwaway information. Like, as I said, like when we get the full context of when Tom Riddle murdered his parents, that, you know, we first knew about it from the Riddle House mystery from the Muggle perspective, and then we get the whole, oh, wow, he actually framed and put a false memory in his uncle to see, like, how intricate that whole thing was, made it, like, even though we kind of already knew the basics of what happened, just giving more and more little minute details in a very entertaining way, which I liked.
Yeah.
Alrighty, so shall we get into the questions?
Yes,
let's do it. Okay, so... we've already discussed the first question. How does this book compare to others we've read thus far, going into our various sentiments and impressions? Question number two, what was your favorite chapter and why?
Do you want me to answer this first?
Yeah. Each one you go first.
Oh, okay. I really like chapter 26, The Cave. Granted, I was talking about the beginning of the end. It was the beginning of the end for my beloved Dumbledore, but it was very tense and spooky and, you know, what do I have? Zombies, mystery, drama, tension. It was all those things and all those elements. I felt like it did a really good job of kind of putting you in the scene through that. And definitely a lot of things happen in there. I mean, if that's kind of not too uncommon with the Harry Potter chapters, a lot of things do happen, but I did like how it's kind of centrally focused on this one kind of scene. I feel like that can be a little unusual. Usually we're like hopping around to classes and stuff like that. So
yeah,
the cave.
And what I liked about the cave that you made me think of just discussing it is the variety we have in terms of Harry confronting, like, the big adventure at the end. So in book one, it's all three of them, the Golden Trio, with Ron and Hermione getting knocked off in the trials, like Fluffy and everything, until finally Harry has to face Voldemort himself. In book two, it's pretty much Ron going on the adventures with him at the end until, again, he has to face the diary riddle alone. And then in the third book, it is Harry and Hermione going back in time. And then in book four, he's all by himself, gets kidnapped for the crazy satanic cult with the cauldron. Book five, it's Harry with the Golden Trio and the Silver Trio of Luna, Neville, and Ginny. So we have this whole, you know, entourage. And then in the sixth book, Harry goes on his adventure with Dumbledore. So it's just, I like comparing this sort of, you know, these different groupings that Harry's put with to face when he has to do the big adventure at the end.
Yeah.
And again, all the other ones have been kids, his peers, like, none of us were anticipating that he's going to go on an adventure with Dumbledore and, like, you know, get nearly die.
Yeah. Sad time. Well, that's an interesting way to think about it. But what was your favorite chapter?
And why? So my favorite chapter was, this one really surprised me because, yeah, I was looking through them and I chose chapter 20, Lord Voldemort's Request. And you're like, which one is that again?
Yeah.
That is the one, at least a chunk of it, is the scene where Dumbledore and Tom Riddle meet again when he's applying for the Defense Against the Dark Arts position.
Okay, yeah.
I appreciated this chapter more so in this rereading because I felt like this is the end of, like, you know, any attempt at civility between Dumbledore and, you know, Tom Riddle, because Tom Riddle is, you know, again, he's disfigured himself by all the crazy magic he's doing, which we now know is creating Horcruxes. You know, he's got all this, you know, stuff that he's doing. He's only just starting to do some really shady things, but not enough to, like, for him to be on anyone's, like, radar quite yet. So right. Just that whole scene, and again, the differing, the banter of ideologies between, like, you know, nothing is worse than death, and it's like, oh, there's nothing I've found in my studies that love is the best of all,
right,
of all magics, then Dumbledore's like, perhaps you've been looking around places. I don't know. I just really appreciated that scene a lot more for what it represented as, again, this final moment of Dumbledore, again, showing regret that he couldn't fix this psychopath, which, yeah, again, never could have fixed him. I don't know if he could have done more to prevent it by warning others. I don't know. But yeah, I just appreciate, you know, the same way I appreciated, you know, the banter between Dumbledore and Voldemort in the Department of Mysteries. We just get these two very powerful wizards on opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah.
You know, being, you know, over glasses of wine, being Cersei Lannister and throwing out shade.
Yeah, very much so. I feel like that's very, like, that seemed very British too, like some of those conversations. I don't know. Nat could answer them for me, but, like, it's traditionally stereotypically very, you know, witty kind of cutting remarks that are, that, you know, I didn't think about this, but as it pains me to say that Dumbledore is flawed, you talked about him being, like, unable to change Tom Riddle. And do you think another wizard could, like, you could say that Dumbledore is so much in his own ego, it's like, I alone can fix him. I just quoted Donald Trump. That's all. I alone can fix it. Anyway, that's beside the point.
Yes. You know, the sad thing is I tend to approach, like, when I've come across very difficult, combative people in my life, particularly one specific person, I've always said to myself, that person is not going to change unless mm-hmm. someone very close to them dies or if they themselves have a near-death experience. Like, only that is going to inspire any sort of personal integrity or any change in moral compass in this person. And so when I apply that sort of, you know, very cynical to Voldemort, the thing with Voldemort and little Tom Riddle, he never formed any healthy attachments.
Yeah.
There's nothing in terms of any others, like, he never evolved beyond the very childish egocentricism. And so there's nothing that he can lose outside of himself that would be like, wow, I got all this power and for what? It's certainly never was going to be a, like, Anakin Skywalker, I did it for you, blah blah right. blah,
or yeah,
you know. So I don't think so, because there's nothing to bargain with.
That's a good point. I mean, there's, yeah, he didn't have any emotional tie to anybody, so, like, that, like, people can be changed, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah, and this wasn't in my favorite quote, which we'll discuss later, but I do like the line that they end with, where Dumbledore's like, the time has long gone when I could frighten you with a burning wardrobe and force you to correct your wrongs, but I wish I could, Tom, I wish I could.
Yeah, well.
Yep. So anyway, yeah, that was me. So for you, what was your least favorite chapter and why?
Maybe I'm just, I don't know. When I was flipping through the books and I was like, what did I not like? I went with chapter 5 in excess of phlegm, and specifically because I don't love when women are pitted against each other and how it reiterates, I can't talk, a stereotype. Like, you know, Jenny and her mom are dogging on Fleur. And sure, she has her annoying characteristics, but like, I don't know if we always need to highlight that. One of the things that is enjoyable about, you know, Ron and Harry's relationships with some women, like, or girls like Hermione and Luna, it's kind of refreshing, but we don't see a lot of like Hermione with a lot of female friends, with the exception of Jenny, I think recently. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a recent development. But I just don't like that. I mean, I'm not dumb enough to think like that's completely illogical and we live in a utopia and every woman is, you know, cool and friendly with each other. But like, we didn't need to highlight it.
Yeah, it's interesting because, yeah, I guess it's naturally by the nature of reading this series post Me Too and just, you know, really, and now people are really making the effort to dissect how sexist the late 90s and early aughts were.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I've watched many a video essay on, you know, those subject matters. But I think, you know, even when Me Too was still was happening, like in 2018, I specifically reread Harry Potter like late 2018, early 2019, when I converted from Christianity to pagan. But that was specifically not so much from a feminist, you know, honing in on that stuff. It was a looking at all the pagan stuff. And it's like, you know, certainly certain elements of the story are inspired by traditional stuff in British folklore and witchcraft, but does it promote witchcraft itself? Of course not. So yeah, I wasn't paying attention in that rereading. Even though Me Too was happening, I wasn't thinking about that in regards to phlegm and some other ways we could look at the series from a feminist lens, which I did more of in this reading.
Cool. Well, what was your least favorite chapter?
My least favorite chapter was 24, Sectum Sempra.
Okay. That, sorry, it shouldn't make me laugh.
No, and I chose it as my least favorite because we see Harry at one of his dumbest points, being a teenage boy and like realizing I could have killed someone. Like, again, the level, like, this is Draco could have died.
Yeah, he could have, yeah.
Yeah, Draco could have died if Snape hadn't been around. And, like, this, and it just reminds me of, again, the level of, again, I've always been the one to defend Harry, that Harry has never been the one to bring the negative energy that Draco and Snape bring to this rivalry. Like, so if anything, you know, that's finally Harry, like, giving it all he's got. But yeah. Again, but he... Like, only because, but he only because he's giving it all he's got because he doesn't know what it is.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that he couldn't just, like, take a teddy bear and point Sectum Sempra and watch the stuffing be ripped out.
He didn't, like, practice it before he did it. He just was just like, oh, let's try it on this guy. Whoops.
Yeah. So it just doesn't, because to me, that level of, again, Draco could have died, that's almost as bad as what we know in the history of the Marauders of Sirius, you know, telling Snape, oh, go down and put, you know, touch the stump of the Whomping Willow. You can see what's going on in there, you know, all the while Remus has transformed into a werewolf.
Right.
And yeah. James had to go and save Snape's ass.
Yeah.
So that is a, again, the Sectum Sempra. Again, just try it out first.
Yeah, that was a little careless.
And especially, and I think I said this in that particular episode, is like the whole joke is Harry's like go-to spell in a fight is Expelliarmus. And so the fact the one time he chose not to go with his main spell and didn't even know what it was and just went horribly wrong. So yeah, I just did not like that chapter in showing, you know, not that it doesn't show that Harry's flawed in other ways, but definitely one of Harry's like lowest points.
Yeah. You'll understand the reason I laughed earlier. It's not, I wasn't laughing at you. I was laughing at that. Anyway, yeah.
Okay. Question number 4. Who is your favorite character outside the Golden Trio? Let me take a stab in the dark.
Dumbledore, of course. But this was a book where he's always been a big presence in the book, but I feel like we got a lot of, like, you know, his actual presence in the book. And that just told me he was going to die. And he did. So, because why would you have such a big character featured so prominently if something big isn't going to happen? So, I'm pretty ride or die Dumbledore. I guess I'm Dumbledore's woman all the way, like Harry.
Dumbledore's woman through and through. Yeah,
through and through. I don't know what else to say. I mean, I feel like everybody probably knew that was what I was going to say.
Yeah, because we haven't... Not that what Dumbledore was discussing with Harry, you know, wasn't serious and wasn't important, but up until this point, we've only really gotten interactions with Dumbledore in dealing with the super, super serious post-adventure.
Right.
You know, trauma and Dumbledore giving some words of wisdom and words of encouragement. And so in this book, we get, you know, a continuation of like a relationship and, you know, Dumbledore, you know, again, praising Harry sometimes and also saying like, I'm not answering that question again. I'm done with this. Like getting frustrated with Harry and like just all the normal things in a human relationship.
Right. Yeah. It kind of made Dumbledore a little more human. Wizard-y. I don't know. It kind of filled his character out a little bit.
Yeah. Took him off from his like Merlin Gandalf like pedestal and been like, and it's like, okay, yeah, he's really, really smart, but he's still, again, this is the guy who uses acid pops as his password.
Right. Yeah. He's still human. What about you, Miss Amy? Who was yours?
Surprising choice. My favorite was Tom Marvolo Riddle.
I had a little feeling that it might be it, but I want to hear why.
Again, coming from a place of morbid fascination of not liking the character Tom Riddle, but rather liking the case study of Tom Riddle. And the fact that the evil child, as we mentioned, is a big part of Gothic literature. And so seeing this evil little child evolve and just be able to feed on his absolute worst instincts. And no, it's obviously, you know, people are always like, oh, what's going on in their head? What's going on in their head? But I think what's also equally important is to see through the memories what other people were thinking as they're seeing this evolution, you know, in real time.
Yeah.
You know. So, yeah, that was, you know, that was my favorite. Just, yeah, getting this whole fleshed out villain.
I can understand that. And you make me feel better about one of my answers I'm going to give later. Because it's a similar kind of thought process.
Mm-hmm. All righty, then. Question number 5. Who is your least favorite character?
It was Snape, but I also didn't really love that Umbridge showed back up at the end, but, I feel like his presence in this book was similar to like Dumbledore's presence in other ones. He's like a big character and he shows up at the end to like mess stuff up, but, so he sucked.
He sucked because he killed Dumbledore.
That is part of it, even though I still think Dumbledore, that was some sort of like suicide pact or something that he had. But yeah, and I think, you know, if I'm just going for like the fringes, I wish Umbridge would have just gone away, but apparently she's still alive and kicking. So
yeah, she's still around. Because yeah, you're right. Snape's presence is substantially subdued in this book. I don't know, is that a balance because we got so much of him in the previous book because of teaching occlumency lessons? Yeah, because we really don't, apart from that one class, the very first Defense Against the Dark Arts class, we don't get that much on the future classes and just over time what Snape is like as a Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher. It's just, you know, that's just put on the periphery.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, Snape sucks.
He does.
Yeah, he sucks a lot. You know, and I, as you know, as I mentioned off mic, I am partaking and subscribing to a lot of content creators that were formerly teachers, and a lot of their comedy and their content is surrounding like teacher problems and stuff. And again, like the whole idea of, you know, certain parents not being able to believe the notion that their child could lie and that their teacher has it out to get them. And like, if ever I'm in that situation, like with a parent or someone else, it's like, dude, I'm not Severus Snape and your kid ain't Harry Potter.
There you go. they'll get that reference, of course.
But yeah, just not that it doesn't exist, but an uncharacteristic, we assume the default is the Snape when it comes right. to teachers, at least in this country, and it is to everyone's detriment, where the real Snapes are the admin and the principals and the superintendents who do not support the teachers.
Agreed.
That's, yeah, I listened to some horror stories of teacher quitting stories of, you know, admins and superintendents, you know, that, again, you just... Again, if you're outside education, you want to see like that, that's not legal, that's not real, and it's like, that's totally fake, and it's like, no, that's true, that's what happens. Like, I don't know what it is about the bubble of education.
It is a battlefield. That's, yeah. I mean, I have some thoughts and feelings, but it's dangerous for a lot of reasons that, what I'm trying to say, I don't want to get into it, because I would go on a tangent, but, the wrong people find it dangerous. That's what I think.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm tickled by that. They think their kid is so great and so special and like so persecuted that they think any teacher that holds them accountable is like a Severus Snape level villain.
Yeah, that's just not true. I mean, kids are dumb and they gotta learn life experiences.
So my least favorite character, and I traditionally, again, this question as I have it worded is what is your least favorite character outside the Golden Trio? But I chose within the Golden Trio. Oh. My least favorite character was Ron.
Why? I mean, other than he's an idiot sometimes, but why?
He's an idiot and he's always been an idiot, but he takes his idiocy to a whole new level, even going beyond the really shitty way he handled the Yule Ball thing in the Goblet of Fire. It's just, if I want to equate another character, maybe not to the same degree, but the way of using women to bolster yourself up because you got nothing else going for you, kind of makes me think of Theon Greyjoy.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. I only know him from the show. I didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. If you ever read it, oh my God, his POV chapters are painful.
Well,
painful as a woman, you know, read. And it's like with Ron or Theon, like I understand the social circumstances of why they're like not very happy or why they're so insecure, but it's like, why does it have to be women, you know, that you shit on to make yourself feel better? Like, that's...
Yeah.
So, yeah. And, again, the idea is that... I guess I'm also holding Ron to a standard because, again, Harry has a certain level of maturity because he's been forced to go on all these adventures.
Right.
But Ron has been going on a good, you know, those adventures that too. So the fact that this sort of not, you know, going on adventures, risking their lives, dealing with very serious issues and very dangerous people, like... Death Eaters, like, I'm just surprised, like, why has that not had a maturing effect on Ron in any capacity?
That's a really good question. Because I was going to say, is it because he's, like, kind of always had seen people in different life stages around him, like, with his brothers, and, you know, just, I don't know, is it an arrested development where he just kind of feels like he can be a kid, and I mean, I know his peers are kind of going through these changes and he's going along with them. But I guess, I don't know. I wonder if it's because he's had family and, you know, older siblings.
Yeah, this is certainly possible. Because I'm just thinking, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, if we want to make Ron a character where, you know, he's really shitty, but he grows out of it, I would have preferred to see this shitty behavior, like, back in Goblet of Fire, which we got some, but not to this extent. Like, I would be more forgiving of this if it was at a younger age.
Yeah. Nice.
But, yeah, it's just really mean, and it's just really unfair that he's just mad at Hermione for something that happened 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like sometimes Ron and I have what am I trying to say? Some their emotional development sometimes is stunted, and Ron could use a little bit more. So,
come on. All right, and then so yeah, broke my own rule and chose someone within the Golden Trio.
That is your right.
Question number 6: what was your favorite magical item that appeared in this book?
I hope this counts as a magical item. I liked Felix Felicis. I
thought that was
great. I know it's more of a potion, but I mean, like, who wouldn't like that? I made a joke that I could argue my drugs are my Felix Felicis anyway, but ha ha ha, whatever. But I also thought the Horcruxes were pretty cool. Magical item. Not one that I don't know. It's just very interesting and complex and, you know, informs the rest of the story, I'm sure, a lot.
Yeah. So. No, I didn't think, but you're right. Yeah. Felix Felicis is a, you know, magical item via a potion, and all the good things happen. And I can also make the argument that my drugs, you know, because again, and especially because I feel so much better, because literally I went a month without one of my meds because the clinic and the pharmacy, my chosen pharmacy, were not talking to each other. And basically they said that, you know, the pharmacy and said, oh, we'll contact your clinic, and nothing was happening. And then I call the clinic and it's like, yeah, you can't trust them even when they say that. So I'm just like,
everything is difficult. Again,
yeah, everything is a battle. Anyway, so I finally have my Felix Felicis and my meds.
That's what I'm going to call it from now on. Yeah.
So yeah, no, good choice. And I wasn't nearly as creative. My favorite, because obviously a big chunk of my, obviously I went for four Horcruxes, but specifically I went towards Slytherin's locket.
Mm.
Because I like that we get a lot of history around that specific Horcrux, even though we don't even know like where it is yet. Like, we first see it at the Gaunt House. We then get Caractacus Burke saying, you know, how he bought it, and then it comes back again with Hepzibah Smith when Voldemort steals it back when he kills her.
We got like the dummy one in this one, right? That's what.
Yes, and then finally, when we go into the cave and we see that it's a locket, we presume, oh, it's Slytherin's locket. So yeah, that was supposed to be and was where it was hidden before mysterious RAB absconded with the real one.
Okay. Yeah. That's interesting.
So yeah. So just of all. Well, we can make an argument as well about Marvolo's ring, because Dumbledore had that one. But yeah, like, I felt like the Slytherin's locket was at the forefront of like all of the Horcruxes thus far. And of course, being the item from Slytherin, which of course, you know, Voldemort's whole like PR personality brand is dependent on the fact that he is the heir of Slytherin, who was this supremacist wizard and, you know, carrying out his pure blood mania legacy.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought, yeah, that's it. I like that you picked a very specific Horcrux instead of in general.
Yeah. Because again, all the cursed stuff, the bad things that happen to people who get it, and it's like the Hope Diamond.
Yeah. Yeah. Where is that thing? Supposedly in the Smithsonian?
I've seen it in the Smithsonian, unless they moved it.
Well, I thought I had heard at some point they put like a fake one out, and the other one is like in But I don't know. I saw it as well, but who the heck knows? I don't know. I thought they had, you know what? I know somebody that works in the museums over there, so I'll ask her. So, there we go.
Yeah, I don't remember. All I remember is that it was taken from an even larger diamond that was originally called the French Hope.
Interesting.
And then, yeah, I don't know where the other pieces went, but yeah. Anyway, Slytherin's Locket, classic gothic-y cursed jewelry. Cursed. Love it.
Yes.
Okay. Question number 7. What was your favorite spell from this book?
This is why I left, because I said Sectum Sempra was my favorite spell. And my reasoning was that it was kind of like a catalyst for Harry to rethink some of his actions. And maybe, you know, he was very impulsive. So I guess not like as, again, a spell I'd like perform, but as far as something that was poignant in the story. Otherwise, I said Aquamenti would be convenient and practical. So.
Interesting. Yeah. Sectum Sempra. Okay. Yeah. Sectum Sempra as a lesson rather than a tool.
Yeah. I would prefer that, like, nobody use that spell, including myself. Mm-hmm. But
do you, now that Harry knows what it is, do you think he'll ever use it again?
Yes. Especially if he's taken that fight with Voldemort, he'll try everything he can. So,
yeah.
Not that would be effective. Anyway, I don't know. Yeah. I'll find out.
Yeah, it would only be effective after the Horcruxes are dealt with. So, my favorite was, of course, Dumbledore's fire conjuring spell.
Oh yeah, that's pretty badass.
Because who doesn't want to conjure fire?
Yeah, I mean that's why Daenerys is so cool.
Yeah, that's Yeah, which I'm still trying to grapple with the difference between the show and the book with Daenerys about Targaryens and fire, because in the book they're not completely flame proof the way Daenerys is.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, or even if Daenerys is in the book, it's because of a very specific thing. It's not specifically her Targaryen blood, like the blood magic, like she did at the pyre and whatever shit. Yeah, again, total rabbit hole sidebar, but. Yeah, just conjuring fire. Who doesn't like that? And
that's pretty cool.
And I come from the place of, you know, studying the Middle East, where, you know, fire is a huge part of Zoroastrianism, and seeing it as a purifying, you know, force energy. Because literally in Iran, for the Persian New Year, Nowruz, a tradition is to jump over, you know, fires as a means, like not like big fires, like we're not killing ourselves, but just to jump over fires as a means of like symbolically purifying oneself.
So if I may be so nosy, like I'm assuming like in that obviously people do that aren't at like a huge celebration. So is like jumping over a candle or like a little fire, does that count?
It's like like jumping over like a campfire.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Or like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and that spread even to some of the Balkan states, like from the Ottoman Empire. Even though they don't celebrate Persian New Year like Nowruz, like on the spring equinox, but still, like the idea of spring, you know, around springtime, you jump over fire that has you know far-reaching effects in certain traditions. Anyway, so yeah, conjuring fire is always cool.
It is always cool. I agree.
Yep. Let's see what else do we got. What was your favorite magical creature that appeared in this book?
I feel like I've said this before, but Fox was my favorite because who doesn't love a phoenix?
Yeah, Kevin would agree with you. Like Kevin, before he read the Harry Potter books, he had a stuffed animal fox, and he just called it his bird.
That's funny.
And so he really loves like Fox and now calls him by his actual name.
That's, hey, Kevin and I can relate on that because Fox is pretty badass. So
yeah, Fox is pretty badass. I also chose a bird-like creature. I chose the return of Buckbeak.
Oh, gotta love Buckbeak.
Because Buckbeak is, you know, Buckbeak's had not had it great. Like, you know, in the beginning, he was probably a happy hippogriff running free, and then Then he goes on the run with Sirius. So he's on the run with Sirius, which that is pretty okay. Then he's hanging out in caves with Sirius. And then he's hanging, like, the ethics of, they just stuffed Buckbeak in Grimald Place, in his mother's bedroom.
That had to be not fun for him,
like,
at all.
Even if it was, like, large enough as, like, stable-wise, like, he couldn't go out, get exercise, and...
Right. Exactly.
Couldn't go be ridden.
Poor Buckbeak. That would have to be just like a little caged animal. That's basically what he was, because it's not small.
No, so. It's the size of a horse.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah. So it's, yeah, so it's nice, because literally we know Buckbeak is in the house, but I don't think there's a single chapter in Order of the Phoenix where we go up to that room and see and, like, interact with Buckbeak at all. It's just there.
Yeah, because he kind of shows up toward the end, but there isn't really a lot of mention of him prior to that. So
yeah, all that we get is I'm feeding Buckbeak when, you know, when Sirius is going upstairs with all this, like, you know, raw meat. And then and then the only mention of, you know, the reason Sirius was unable to see Harry in the fire and Creature lying to him is because Sirius was busy because Buckbeak had been injured deliberately by Creature to distract Sirius.
Creature's an ass.
Yeah, Creature. Creature is a, you know, hashtag Hippogriff's Lives Matters.
Yes, exactly.
So it's nice that he's back with Hagrid and having a more appropriate life for a Hippogriff.
A good Hippogriff.
And of course, you know, he attacked Snape while Snape was fleeing the castle, which was awesome.
Yes, that's always good, because especially after that, I think that the magical creatures, like, knew what was happening. Speaking of magical creatures, my cat was digging through my drawer and I had to stop him. So
you're right. And so my next question, what was the most gothic element in this book? There's lots to choose from.
Yeah, there really are. So I kind of picked two. I said, and I guess, the demise of Dumbledore and the torment of Malfoy. So I was thinking of the cave and the Spinner's End. And I think I think we talked a lot about the cave, and that's, to me, like I said, kind of gothic horror. But then as far as Malfoy goes, like, he's definitely had, like, a, his father's in jail. He's got, like, that very dark familial kind of situation, and how at the very end, you know, he's, I'm such a badass. And then he's faced with this thing that would, like, kind of cement him as a badass, like, in the Dark Lord's, you know, eyes, and he doesn't do it. And Dumbledore knows he's not going to do it. So I felt like that his story alone could have been its own gothic novel.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, it's because the tragic figure, you know, heir or son of a prestigious family, and it's like, you know, they're not directly as evil as their parents or the people around them, but at the same time, they're complicit to a certain extent. And again, in Draco's case, whether they're underage or not, like, how much agency or blame do we assign to that with that complicity?
Yeah.
Interesting. Oh, yeah. No, good choices. Most gothic element I thought of was the evolution of Tom Morvolo Riddle, and I was specifically honing in not on, like, directly child sociopath, but really that so much of gothic literature is, you know, commentary on society. Certainly, yeah. That's how it began with Anne Radcliffe's novels in the 1790s, were very, very heavily inspired by ideals from the French Revolution, and was super anti-Catholic, anti-organized, you know, religion, you know, calling out the corruption in the feudal, you know, lord, the classism, and the religion as well. So, Gothic history has always been, you know, critiquing, you know, various elements of our society. And so via Tom Morvolo Riddle, I think we're, it's critiquing society in terms of how the societal neglect of this one troubled child and how that continual neglect allowed for a really terrible person, you know, evil person to be created.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, his story too, if you could put it in like the, even before he becomes Voldemort, that could be its own gothic novel as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I would, yeah. I'd want that novel.
You should write that novel, Amy. Like, that's what you should do.
Yeah. Be way better than Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes or whatever shit.
Oh, gosh. Yes. President Snow.
Yeah. So, yeah, because, just the neglect of left him in an orphanage, even though he was magical, and in terms of Dumbledore's actions or inactions in regards to Tom Riddle while he was at school, it's a complicated situation where it's like, you know something about someone, but if you say anything, it's like, oh, you're just trying to pit me against them, you know, blah blah blah. And it's right. Like, you know, a lot of times you have to just wait for people to figure it out themselves.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to do sometimes, but yeah.
Yeah, because, but I still lean towards the fact that if Dumbledore saw that no visible improvement was being made with Tom Riddle, maybe a few of the other teachers, and I'm just like, hey, you know, this is what happened at the orphanage. He was killing animals and
yeah.
Hanging rabbits from the rafters, you know, awful. Maybe we should keep, you know, just keep an eye on him.
I just got stressed out because I'm an animals over people kind of person. So.
Because him knowing that, and, you know, certainly, not really, because in the Chamber of Secrets, Moaning Myrtle died, you know, in the sense of only Dumbledore knowing, he was able to protect, you know, students maybe directly in the castle from immediate harm, but by not kind of being more aggressive in like trying to shut this stuff down, Voldemort was allowed to fuel his ideology and his sense of superiority and get friends who became Death Eaters. So like, even though he kept most of the students from immediate harm by keeping an eye on Tom Riddle himself, like, he wasn't able to stop the whole very force. Because what the ethics of this, I'm sure Dumbledore could have framed something to get the kid committed.
Yeah, I'm sure he could have. And I think he's got, like, sway and swagger no matter what, like, world he's in, so.
Yeah, so, anyway. So, yeah, just, you know, because so many children get left behind because society does not care.
That's very true.
And then and then people get mad when they become dependent on the system or whatever, are not as productive in society as they could be.
Yeah.
Then question number 10, what was your favorite quote from this book?
I'm going to shock everybody, and it's from Dumbledore.
Dumbledore has a lot of them this book.
He's just a very quotable character. It is, "The unknown we fear when we look upon death and darkness, nothing more." I think that just kind of speaks for itself. And it's definitely a philosophy of life that makes sense. And Voldemort kind of, you know, perpetuates this like idea of violence. And, you know, he's very like, and death is the worst thing. And Dumbledore says multiple times, like, there are worse things than death. So, are there, aren't there? I think that's the quote I just read is a good way of framing that kind of same idea.
Yes, I have a deeper appreciation for that quote now because, as we've discussed off mic, I have found a niche in paganism and eclectic witchcraft where I am delving into shadow mysticism. So, seeing the good energies within darkness.
That is, yeah.
So, yeah, I didn't write this one down, and I don't want to go into it in depth because we kind of discussed about it quite extensively in the cave chapter, is the quote of, "Age is foolish and forgetful when it underestimates youth."
Oh, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and we discussed that in depth. Specifically, I related that to how our society shits on female forms of entertainment, or, you know, forms of entertainment that are, whose fan bases are primarily female.
Yes.
You know, and particularly very young female. So I don't, we don't have to have that conversation again. So one of them, just happy and whimsical, because I like to think I'm applying this into my own life right now, is one of the, when Dumbledore goes to pick up Harry from the Dursleys, and before they leave, he's like, "Let us step into the night and pursue that flighty temptress adventure."
That's a very whimsical and good quote. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, because I just felt that, you know, so many heavy stuff, but it's like, more sense of, yeah, you need to go live life. And I feel like I'm applying that specifically in, you know, making time for my writing and pursuing that flighty mistress of, you know, being an artist, even if not professionally, just allowing myself to be a creative, yeah, in a way that I wasn't giving myself permission to before, because life is short.
It is extremely short. Yes, it is. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so that was one I had. And then another one I had, which I, it's comes when Harry is being confused about why Percy is still not talking to the family, even though, you know, in Ministry's line now is, oh yeah, Voldemort's back. We, you know, Harry Potter was right. So even with all that, Percy is not, you know, reconciled with the family. And I think Hermione or someone else says to Harry, like, Dumbledore says people find it far easier to forgive others for being wrong than being right.
Yeah, that's pretty true, isn't it? Like,
mm-hmm. Honestly, this makes me think of, like, when parents, you know, try either or mad or discipline their kids only to realize that they got it wrong and their kid was telling the truth, or, you know, they misread a situation in some capacity, and just some parents cannot say sorry to the kid.
Yeah, I just listened to I'm Glad My Mom Died by Jeanette McCurdy.
I'm hearing great things.
Yeah, and that's something that, you know, her mother was a extreme narcissist, and that is definitely something that you see over and over again. Obviously, teaching your daughter at 11 years old how to count calories is not a good thing, but
yeah. And I think it really hones into, I think it also applies to the greatly divided nature of our politics and our society, you know, on a political basis, because as people constantly point out, if you're trying to convince someone of an opposing position to what they currently hold, then, like, statistics and, like, facts and are not going to work. And if anything, there's no, again, people are so obsessed with saving face that unless there's a face saving way out of something, or like change a face saving way to change their position, they will just continue with that incorrect position, even if they know at some level that it's been disproven, just because there's no easy, you know, they don't perceive there being a way to save face.
Yeah, that's really kind of sad, because, like, it's okay to be wrong. I'm wrong a lot. It's annoying, it sucks, but it's also, like, it's fine.
Yeah, because literally, you know, I hate that there's so many people who the only way to prove to them that they were wrong was for them to be in agony with COVID.
Yeah, exactly. That's a pretty hard lesson for a lot of people to learn. So
yeah. So anyway, yep, those were my quotes.
They were good.
Yeah. Alrighty then. Question 11. So rank your favorite to least favorite of the books we've read thus far.
Okay. Prisoner of Azkaban, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, Half-Blood Prince. So the one we just read, obviously. Goblet of Fire, 3. Order of the Phoenix, 4. 5, Philosopher's Stone. And last, Chamber of Secrets. Mm-hmm. Big reason the spiders in that one. I'm, like, with Ron on that.
Okay, so I'm curious, why has Prisoner of Azkaban, why is Prisoner of Azkaban staying at the top?
I really, like, when I think about Harry Potter and I think of, like, the moment that kind of hooked for me was the Shrieking Shack and kind of the Marauders coming together and the reveal of, you know, Lupin being werewolf, and then also in that book, Sirius being, you know, not really the person that they were looking for. I just thought there was a lot of like gothic scariness, or like just the atmosphere of that one I really liked. So
it further played into what we consider your preference of gothic horror versus my preference of gothic romance.
I think so. I think so. I think that's one where that one kind of resides, and I like that, those vibes.
Yeah. And then, yeah. And I was going to ask, why is Chamber of Secrets the lowest? Literally because of the spiders.
That's part of it. I just don't remember that one too fondly. I remember the Whomping Willow. And then it just kind of was like, it was kind of just fine. I don't know. I mean, the spiders didn't help anything.
Yeah. Well, again, there are plenty of people in the fandom who share your position of Chamber of Secrets being the absolute weakest one. I personally don't agree, just because it's a quieter mystery. And again, I appreciate book two specifically in its relation to book six and how they connect thematically more so than I think any other two books within the series. But yeah, again, you are not alone.
Yeah. And that's not to say like I strongly dislike it. It's fine. It's just like out of
all the badass Whomping Willow and everything, you know, else.
Yeah. The Whomping Willow was fine, but the spiders were scarier.
Yeah. Alrighty then. So here are mine. I have number one is still Order of the Phoenix. Number two is Half-Blood Prince.
Okay.
Number three is Prisoner of Azkaban. Number four is Goblet of Fire. Number five is Chamber of Secrets. And number six is Philosopher's Stone.
Oh, okay. All right.
Again, and I think I've, you know, beating dead horse of why, you know, Order of Phoenix is my favorite. Because, I've had the very personal experience of a smear campaign. And so that's just a very unique, peculiar experience that I unless someone else has gone through a smear campaign, I don't expect them to understand or appreciate it. So, yep. And then again, Philosopher's Stone, not that it's bad, but again, it's coming off as very whimsical and like, oh, you know, again, everyone says that things don't get like dark until four. And then even you can make argument things don't get dark until three. But quite frankly, I think things get dark by book two.
I mean, like the end of the Philosopher's Stone was the, Quirrell drinking unicorn blood, right?
Ah, yes, indeed.
Like, that's not something that, I don't think that ever happened in Little House on the Prairie. I don't know, but I mean.
Yeah, and also I just, even though the, I don't know, it's like, I just felt like it was all very jumbled more. I guess I didn't feel like there were some certain themes. Like the mystery itself is really good and how they set up Quirrell and how they revealed Quirrell as the villain, but all the many tasks and like obstacles, yeah, it was very too much like, you know, video game, whereas, you know, even in the Goblet of Fire, I could better appreciate, you know, the tasks that are assigned to Harry. But anyway, again, not that it's not good, it's just I felt there were themes in the other books I like more.
Yeah, I almost would put five and six on my list. One and two kind of on the same level. I kind of debated that too. I'm like, yeah, I didn't like the spiders and that was, but the Philosopher's Stone, it's just the entrance to the world. That's why it kind of ranked higher for me.
But. Mm-hmm, right. And again, that is also a sentiment very much held in the fandom of that's, it's the entrance, it's the nostalgia of entering this world the first time compared to the very quiet element of Chamber of Secrets, which is why it wins out usually.
Interesting.
Yeah. Alrighty then. So those are all the prep questions. I had a few extra questions that I wrote down that if you would be interested in, they're just three that I thought of.
Sure. Yeah. And I feel like I saw those and I was trying to think about them. And then I was like, I just kind of want to hear what Amy has to say about this. Cause I know you've probably got something some thought, and I, yeah. So
yeah. So just one thing I thought of is, like, what do we think about the culture of alternative names? Because obviously, we've always known, you know, ever since book two, that Tom Marvel Riddle is the half. No, he's not. He's not the Half-Blood Prince. He is Lord. Tom Marvel Riddle is, you know, Lord Voldemort, which his name is literally an anagram of jumbling the letters together to say I'm Lord Voldemort. And now we have another character, another villain in the story who took on a pseudonym of, like, the Half-Blood Prince, you know. And the fact, you know, not it's not an anagram, but it is playing on his mother's maiden name.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, so just what do we think about this culture of, again, changing names? Because when I think about it, I just think about it in terms of, you know, writers use pseudonyms, you know, all the time. Like, some of it is for legitimate privacy, some of it is purely marketing strategy. Like, I was sitting on a, like, virtual book club meeting with Riley Sager, one of my favorite authors.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so he literally, it was not, he just chose a pseudonym because literally he had published things under his name that didn't sell, and basically the publisher was like, you want this to sell, you need to change your name.
What is his name? Because I had heard that criticism.
I don't remember.
Well, and I had heard because people, it sounds more like a girl's name. So.
Yeah, and again, that's a whole separate thing of people, like, people were accusing him of, like, deliberately trying to take a woman's name when Riley is a unisex name. And he's like, literally, I didn't even think of that. I just was told by my publisher that marketing-wise, this needs to happen.
That is, that's interesting. As far as it is in relation to, I mean, I almost feel like it's just kind of like a, I don't know, it's trying to, like, separate identity, isn't it, from, you know, this is who I was Tom Riddle in the past and that, but now I'm Lord Voldemort, or yeah. I was, I don't know.
Yeah, it's trying to externalize and manifest, like, a different aspect of oneself, which, you know, Hollywood has saturated the whole, like, multiple personality disorder, which isn't even called that. It's been not been fully discredited, but it's like dissociative identity disorder, and like, it doesn't happen all that often the way Hollywood would portray it does. Also, I think of who else, more recent movie, From Estella to Cruella.
I didn't know that. I haven't watched that movie yet.
I haven't watched it. I haven't watched either. All I know is that, you know, Estella was, just, I've only seen the final monologue by Emma Stone, and it's like Shakespearean. It's so good.
Oh, really? I'll have to check that. I'll have to watch it. You know, I just want to interject really quickly. Oh, I just realized I put a tea bag in my pocket. Riley, I was trying to hide it from my cat. Riley Sager's real name is Todd Ritter. That just sounds really close to Tom Riddle, so I just thought I'd have to share that.
Oh dear. So yeah, and it's, and I did once, like, I think I wrote a short story or like a fan fiction where, like, there was this, like, female, like, jewelry thief, and, like, her nickname was, like, the Shadow Countess.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So, yeah. So just this, it's not just, you know, having a different identity, but literally like using terms of like the peerage or like royalty, the Half-Blood Prince, Lord Voldemort, trying to put one on this elevated status, like this sense of grandeur.
Yeah. That's, I mean, I don't know. That's, I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, obviously there's some ego involved in that because they feel like they have to lord and have to.
Yeah, and they feel, and it's especially weird in Snape's case, because in some ways, like, they're both trying to compensate for the fact that they're half-bloods in a society that, you know, is still very pure blood prejudiced and leaning.
Yeah.
So that inferiority complex of feeling they have to like overcome it.
Yeah, it's a lot of insecurity. But I mean, Harry Potter isn't changing his name to like the Chosen One. I mean, he rejects that very, you know, it kind of irritates him. Yeah, where these people kind of embrace it and named him, gave themselves their name. So weird. Yeah.
So anyway, so I was just thinking about that again. I've come across that in terms of when I was publishing my poetry collections. How did I want to use a pseudonym for that, or would I want to maybe use a pseudonym if I were to branch out into different genres? You know, because I know authors who, like, literally I interviewed one author who like has a slightly different name depending on the genre she's writing. And for me personally, at least with myself published poetry, like I choose my current name. I use my current name because, again, with the smear campaign, you know, there were people that wanted to, you know, basically have me be ashamed of that name. And I'm just like, no, screw you. I'm going to be stubborn about it.
That's admirable. I've horsed around with my name on resumes when applying for jobs just to see, because I've heard, you know, there's sexism in job application too. So just seeing, you know, if J period last name, you know, if that, what kind of response that elicits. And now with, you know, other, you know, there's so many ways to figure out who somebody is. It's kind of, in job hunting, it's kind of a difficult thing. But authorship, speaking of she who shall not be named herself does that. So
yeah, and was told and did it because boys won't wanna, even if the main character is a boy, boys don't want to read books written by women.
Yeah.
But only they knew that it was Harry was the true writer.
Right, exactly.
If only they knew.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Ethan. And then another question I had is, what does this book show us about radicalization?
In what context? One? Yeah, I'm like, what do you mean by this?
I think about the context of the radicalization of Tom Arolo Riddle. I think about the radicalization of Malfoy, even though it's probably would be considered maybe incomplete. Like, just this whole story is structured on, you know, fight, you know, it is a personal, like, you get crime story of this wizard killed the main character's parents, but it's in a wider context of they want the pure bloods to run everything, and a lot of people aren't really down with that. And so that in essence is what we're dealing with right now today. A lot of people want the US and by extension the world to go in a way kind of go back to the post-war glory of, you know, pristine white Christian, you know, utopia that they perceive as having been an actuality in the 50s, and realizing that that image is just slipping further and further away with the demographics changing, you know, and that sparking a lot of vitriol and a lot of, you know, violence on both individual and collective scales.
Yeah, that's a very, I mean, idealistic, they, I think, thought. And again, like, I think the argument that I always hear is like, oh, that was wonderful for who? It was wonderful for a very specific, you know, class and race. So of course, I mean, the radicalization also, you know, I think we've seen that play out in our elections, obviously, in allegiance to a certain someone, just kind of unquestioning allegiance to, which is, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. In fact, as I told you off mic, I've been listening to a lot of and watching a lot of World War II documentaries. And one of, in talking about how the Americans finally entered the war, a good chunk of them were African American. And, you know, they got to Europe. And at that point, it was 1917, you know, they're so desperate for aid that they're so happy the Americans are there that they're just treating the black men, just like, you know, being customers and like interacting with them and like being pleasant with them. And to the point that the Europeans were being so nice to the black soldiers that they literally tried, the officers tried to decrease and minimize interactions because they didn't want them to see again, oh, this is what is like what it's like when white people are nice to me, and just go back to segregation in America.
Jeez, that's awful, man.
So radicalization. I think I mentioned quite a bit in this throughout these chapters is, you know, people underestimating Malfoy in the same way they underestimate the threat of white supremacists, and the threat of, even if the movement is not centralized per se in the way like a mob, like the mobsters were, or organized crime is, the fact that there is a cohesive enough area on the dark web where they can share these ideas and glean inspiration from each other, to the point that they're literally talking about like kill counts, like it's an aspiration to kill as many people as possible.
Yikes, that's awful. That's,
oh, I hear Squeaky meow.
Yeah, he's sorry.
Yep. All right, I have, oh, oh, he's so big now. Oh,
I know.
So big.
Gibbous, hello. All right, go over here, bud. Oh, he's just
okay. Busting. One last question. How do you feel Half-Blood Prince expands upon the theme of governmental politics from Order of the Phoenix?
Yeah, I think, I mean, and I guess kind of the quick answer that I can think of, sorry, it's like having a child, is... at the end, you know, that, well, and at the beginning too, wasn't there at the beginning the kind of
the ministers talking? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that definitely kind of expands on what was occurring in the Order of the Phoenix. And then at the very, very end, when Scrimshaw shows up and is still trying to get Harry to kind of like be the poster boy for the ministry, and he's like, hell no. So
yeah, so what I took out of this is, obviously, Order of the Phoenix is the big political novel, and I think the continuation of, again, seeing the Minister of Magic, of having Harry interact with the Minister of Magic both at Christmas and at the funeral, I think it's a testament of, you know, obviously things were really bad under Fudge, who was like doing everything trying to undermine Harry and Dumbledore. So in a way, you know, but then when Fudge gets out, and even though the Ministry of Magic is quote unquote on the right side of history now, like doing what they can to you know, to defend against Voldemort, it very much shows that at best the government is corrupt, and at worst it's incompetent.
Yeah.
There wasn't any sense of, oh, like Rufus Scrimshaw, like he was head of the Aura office, he's gonna sweep in and save the day. And it just is a testament that, like in many governments and organizations and anything with a group of people, that usually replacing one person, even that person is high up, does not immediately negate all these institutionalized and systemic issues.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like, the damage done by one politician is, you know, takes a while to undo, just like the good that some politicians do. And then, you know, who gets credit for it? It's just such a weird, it's just weird. And I feel like our kind of collective consciousness or whatever, just what we see play out in the news, is so rapid anymore. You know, what's the headline of the day? What's the tweet of the day? What's the thing of the moment? So,
yeah,
but it's just politics. I feel like people blame each other. I don't know. And it's messy. Yeah,
blaming each other, like the home warranty and the technician were blaming each other in dryer gate at my house, because I couldn't get my freaking dryer, clothes dryer. It just needed a little timer replaced on it. It wasn't that hard. It was not this huge thing, but still it took so much time and so many calls and being a Karen.
Life is hard right now. That's what, yep. I feel like that's the theme of life right now.
Yep. Alrighty then. So yeah, that's all I had. That's all the further questions I had for Half-Blood Prince. Did you want to, anything else you wanted to add?
No, just RIP Dumbledore. Yeah. And the title of the next book is The Deathly Hallows. So I am assuming I will see some more Deathly Hallows.
Yeah. More? I don't think, have we seen any Deathly Hallows yet?
I was going to call the Horcruxes are kind of a Deathly Hallow in a way, maybe. Mm. But
yeah. Maybe it's like the diary. Maybe we've seen one and you just don't know it.
Could be. I feel like I've been tricked before.
Yeah. So yeah, thanks for tuning in, and we will pick up next week with Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, chapters 1 and 2. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophia Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophia Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophiaMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophia Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophiaMareStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.